Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 28th of February, tomorrow heading into March. The sequester is likely to happen tomorrow unless something miraculous happens today. And there doesn't seem to be, maybe there was more concern about this last week than there is this week. We have a lot to talk about this hour. We'll get a brief history of how we've come to this point, who thought up the idea of a sequester. The budget deficit, most would agree, needs to be reduced. Is the sequester the right way to do this or the wrong way to do this? And we'll, of course, look at what will happen to people who will be affected by this, people who are unemployed, certainly, federal subsidies for school construction, clean energy, state and local public works, air problems may take place as a result of this sequester, who will be disrupted, and will it affect all of us, and how will we move beyond this? We have two guests with us this hour to talk about all of this, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. Let me give you our phone number. Join the conversation whenever you'd like at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Steven Isberg is associated professor of finance at the University of Baltimore. Professor Isberg, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Our great pleasure. Professor Nathan Smith, Assistant Professor of Business Administration, Finance, and Economics at Fresno Pacific University, is also with us. Professor Smith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Let's start with you, Professor Isberg. Give us a little bit of a history lesson. Who thought up this idea of sequester?
Well, I think the sequester was just another act of Congress and the president kicking the can down the road so it would land sometime after the election. I think they wanted to avoid making hard choices on the budget prior to the election. I think both sides wanted to see how the election would shake out and who would come out on top. The interesting thing is that there doesn't appear to be that much of a shift. And, you know, by kicking the can down the road, they've just actually made the deficit problem a little worse and now increased the urgency, or at least the apparent urgency, of having to deal with it. And I actually think the whole plan of the sequester and what they've done is number one, it's inadequate. It's a very non-substantive set of cuts when it comes to the long-run sustainability of the revenue spending gap. And, you know, in my view, it's a very pathetic political maneuver, which is designed to have a disproportionate impact on middle America and kind of make us feel a pinch with things like teacher cuts, defense spending cuts, which threaten everybody's feeling of security, and then, you know, cuts to the FAA that might impact flights and, you know, make us wait in airports for extra 90 minutes here and there. So, you know, I think the political maneuvering here is kind of pathetic, and I think that's how we got to where we are.
Professor Smith, is there any chance today that we may move away from where we are and somebody will come up with some kind of plan to keep this from happening?
Oh, well, as far as the back and forth, I mean, it doesn't seem very likely, but, I mean, nobody predicted the sequester would be passed at the time it was. I think these kind of negotiations are very hard to read exactly what's going to happen. I think right now there isn't that much resistance at the level of public opinion.
Right.
I think people are fairly neutral, so it's possible that if that changes, then Congress might feel some pressure to do something differently. But the Republicans, I think, are really reluctant to do anything that raises taxes again, since they just raised taxes at the beginning of the year. So they would probably insist on some kind of, basically all spending cuts. And the Obama administration is really reluctant to do things that way. And so that kind of makes it hard to come up with a deal. I think there's a possibility you could get some kind of larger grand bargain, in which you could get maybe some revenue increases, through, well, they say closing loopholes. I mean, through eliminating deductions without raising rates at the margin, and at the same time, some sort of larger long-term cuts to entitlement spending. But it's hard to say whether that would be a good thing to do right now. It would depend a lot on the details of whatever was negotiated.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's hard to predict, but I think it's more likely than not. I think, it's probably going to go through at this point.
And we seem to have more public concern about this. The news was covering this in a fairly dramatic fashion last week. This week, nobody seems to be saying a whole lot about it. Is it the case, Professor Isberg, that we're suffering a bit from fiscal crisis fatigue?
Oh, that's definitely a possibility. It may be that a lot of people are thinking about this and seeing that in fact, you know, the impact of these cuts is not going to be felt immediately. It's a series of phased-in cuts. Again, they're not substantive when it comes to resolving the longer-run problem of this gap between federal revenue and spending. So, what interests me the most is what you do see in the news, you know, relates to things like how it's going to affect the military, how is it going to affect our wait time at the airport,
right.
How is it going to affect our teachers, things that people value. And that's where I think it's kind of misdirected our focus, and we really should be paying attention somewhere else. And maybe it's good that we're not paying too much attention to what's going on in this case. Maybe that's a way of us saying, look, guys, you got a bigger crisis to solve here. You better look at some more fundamental underlying issues here before we move on.
Let's look at the issue of the budget deficit. Does it need to be reduced immediately?
Well, one of the problems you run into is that, it's not necessarily the deficit that you run from year to year. It's the fact that the deficit accumulates over time. A government can afford to run a deficit occasionally as long as it makes up for those deficits by running surpluses occasionally. And, for the longest amount of time, the U.S. government's budget would run into and out of deficits and into and out of surpluses. And it really hasn't been until 1970 that the budget started to run at a consistent deficit, and we started to accumulate increasing debt levels. And now we're to the point where the debt level may actually be above the GDP.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that leads you to is what it costs you now just to service that debt is close to 10% of the federal revenue. So that inhibits your ability to spend in other areas, and just puts an increasing burden on the taxpayers to carry the debt. So it's really a problem of not necessarily what's happening this year, but what has been happening for the last 40 years that we're dealing with.
Professor Smith, what's the best way to reduce the deficit?
Oh, well, that completely depends on what your political leanings are. So if you're conservative, the best way to reduce the deficit is through cutting spending. If you're if you're a liberal, then probably you'd rather do it through raising taxes on the rich. And as far as whether more can be said than that, I mean, I think one thing is that right now, interest rates are really low. So that kind of suggests it's not something that we desperately need to do immediately. I mean, it would be a very different situation if the government were having to spend really high interest rates, and if you were pushing up against the limits of what the market was willing to buy.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that interest rates are low says the opposite. It says, at least for now, the markets are willing to buy a lot of government debt, and that maybe it isn't so urgent to reduce it. But in the long run, one other thing I would add, deficits have been really high in the past 3 or 4 years. Yes, we've been running deficits for 40 years, and actually, in principle, it can be sustainable to run deficits every year if they're small and if the economy is growing. But for the past few years, we've been running deficits that are way above any economic growth rate that we're likely to achieve. We've definitely been on an unsustainable path recently. And the other thing is that you've got the retirement of the baby boomers coming up I guess it's sort of underway already.
Sure,
but that's
it is.
To increase spending on the elderly a lot, increase
mm-hmm.
the Social Security bill, increase the Medicare bill. And so if you do projections out into the future, then we just run into sort of catastrophic problems you could call it excessive spending, or I mean, I guess if you figure that it's affordable if we raise taxes enough, some people would argue that. As far as me personally, I'd say the best way to reduce the deficit is probably to reduce spending on elderly people who, some elderly people are already affluent and have a lot of outside resources, and so I'd probably say, well, spend less on those people. But I mean, of course, anything you do has some downside. In that case, the downside would be people have less of an incentive to save for when they're old, if they expect to that they'll at least some people will have an incentive to save less. If they think that's going to reduce the amount of money that they get from the government.
Professor
My colleague made a good point about the interest rates, and the caveat here, the thing we have to be careful of, is that one of the reasons that those interest rates are so low is that federal monetary policies the Fed Monetary Authority has been pushing reserves into the system consistently for the last 5 years, and that's kept interest rates low. It's kept interest rates low in a moderately inflationary environment. So we've slowly seen real income getting chewed up in the process. You know, the other main source of funding for those low rates is coming from offshore investments. The Chinese are plowing all of the their export dollars back into U.S. federal debt to keep their export markets open. And, you know, there are already now some concerns showing at the Federal Reserve about the underlying inflation, and, you know, whether or not it might be appropriate to start slowing that monetary growth down. And if that happens, you could see our problems exacerbate very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to phone calls, and I want to do that in just a moment, you have talked about the elderly. Is it absolutely goofy, let's start with you, Professor Isberg, about this, to think that we can tackle the budget deficit without looking at those huge ticket items, and that's Social Security and Medicare?
Well, you know, this is obviously an issue. When it comes to the deficit problem, I prefer to go back to the economy and look at the underlying issues in the economy, which have led to long-term shifts in the tax base and, the way the federal government spends money to begin with. I think we've got some more fundamental problems there, which, if corrected, then I think the Medicare and Social Security problem actually go away. Because what's happened over the last 40 years is that as a result of what's been going on in the global economic realignment, we've seen a substantial shift in the distribution of income in this country. And along with that shift, the tax base has shifted. One of the reasons I think you see President Obama talking about taxing at higher rates at the higher income classes is that more income has shifted up there, so more of the tax base is currently there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very politically unpalatable to the Republican side. You know, what's happened in the middle class is that, you know, the median income is shifting down. Average compensation rates in both nominal and real terms are shifting down. This is reducing, you know, the breadth of the tax base. So, you know, you now turn to a solution where, well, and, you know, the tax base is getting narrower, so what we have to do is increase the rate. That's just going to put more and more of a burden on people. What we really need to do is think about how we can create growth opportunities in the economy. And part of the problem with the sequester and the lack of resolution of the fiscal problem is that it makes planning for business investment very difficult. You're adding a lot of uncertainty to the environment. And, you know, there's not a whole lot of new investments being funded. Most of the low interest rate debt now is being used to consolidate industries and reduce jobs and compensation as opposed to growing jobs and compensation. And that's an issue that we have to address first. If you take care of that issue, a lot of our federal budget deficit problems go away. As my colleague has mentioned, you can sustain small deficits if your economy continues to grow.
Professor Smith, your thoughts on that?
So as far as the slow growth in the economy, there hasn't been that much investment for the past few years. I think people got spooked by the financial crisis. That's not surprising that they would sort of pull back on investing money when they've become so uncertain about the future. But I think that uncertainty has lingered, and there could be a lot of debates as to why. If you believe in certain theories about sort of rational expectations and stuff, you would say probably one of the reasons is that given that we're running enormous deficits, then investors are going to be worried about where is the government eventually going to claw that money back from? And you don't want to be the sitting duck, the guy who's invested a lot of money in someplace where it's kind of fixed, where it can't be moved, and where it's easy for the government to tax. You want to wait until it's established how the government is going to raise taxes to get the revenue that they need to pay back the deficit they've run. Wait until that's clear and then decide to invest where the taxes are not going to fall so much. And so I think it may actually help that we've now been doing some things to cut the budget deficit. I mean, particularly we raised taxes at the end of the year. Now it looks like we're going to push a bunch of cuts through. The direct effect on that is probably harmful to the economy because it means people have a little bit less money to spend. And it means that, on both sides, it means you have less money to spend. You have less money to spend because the government's taxing you more, and some people have less money to spend because the government isn't putting it into their pockets by spending it. But investors may look at this and say, okay, now we're starting to see at least a little bit of how the government is going to get its budget back into balance. And so maybe I feel a little bit more comfortable now with investing money. So to that extent, I'm kind of optimistic about this. I mean, I think people have looked at this process and it looks kind of ugly. It looks like everything's being done by sort of artificial crises and in this sort of panicky fashion. And it is true that it would be nice if they could come to sort of reasoned agreements rather than having everything be done at the last minute in this way without people being able to find much compromise. But I think the result may nonetheless not be that bad. I think Obama won the election, and he clearly ran on raising taxes on the rich, so he had a mandate for that. So I think in that sense, the fiscal cliff deal was appropriate. But at the same time, the House GOP also won re-election, and they were running against taxes. So I think it's quite reasonable for them now to say, yeah, we don't really have a mandate to authorize more taxes. But they also had a mandate to cut spending, which they've been pushing on hard. And now we've got some of both.
Well, we sure do. We'll welcome phone calls. Our guests this hour are Professor Nathan Smith, who was just speaking, Assistant Professor of Business, Administration, Finance, and Economics at Fresno Pacific University. Professor Steven Isberg is Associated Professor of Finance at the University of Baltimore. The sequester, the cuts in federal spending set to begin tomorrow. There appears to be less than 24 hours before tomorrow, no indication that there's going to be any kind of deal reached, and so it looks probable that this will happen. What do you think? Are you concerned? Why can't Congress and the administration get together on these issues? Why do we have fiscal cliff after fiscal cliff after fiscal cliff? 800-486-8655 is the number. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dent Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Thursday, we're going to talk about The Boss. Bruce Springsteen, new biography by Peter Ames Carlin. And it is one of those biographies where Springsteen actually spent quite a bit of time speaking with Peter. It covers his birth up until 2011. We'll also hear some tunes. So that's the second hour of the show today. Lots of response to today's first hour. Let's go to Jonathan in Watertown first. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Linda. excuse me. Hey, I was just going to say that I think it's really hard for Democrats and Republicans to come to agreement because, I mean, they're so concerned about campaign money. I mean, I was reading someplace that the Koch brothers donated to over half of the senators' campaigns. So I think it's really hard for them to come on an agreement. Also, I don't understand why they took a week recess in the middle of such an important part or an important debate, and they needed to come up with a solution, and they went on vacation.
Professor Isberg.
Well, one of the interesting things about the way our two-party system has evolved is that, and if you take a look at the presidency as an example, if you want to get the nomination of your party, you have to appeal to the party base. And I think what both sides are doing right now is posturing for the sake of appealing to the party base. And the party base in the Democratic Party, you know, lies fairly well to the left of where most middle Americans fall. And I think the party base in the Republican Party lies pretty far off to the right from where most middle Americans fall. So, you know, what you're seeing there is the posturing that they have to do. And, you know, on the other side, if you take a look at the financing, financing of both sides is typically coming from the same group. And, you know, the vested interests are financing both parties, funding both parties to guarantee themselves access. And, you know, when you add those two factors together, the combination of posturing plus the fact that the same group is essentially funding the political parties, it's not too difficult to see why they're so paralyzed. Because eventually they're going to pay attention to they're going to have to pay attention to both. They're going to have to pay attention to their funding sources. And, you know, as a result, they're going to be very reluctant to do anything that's going to cut the major benefit that those funding sources are lobbying for. And, you know, that's one of the unfortunate things about our structure right now, and that's built some systemic problems into our political economy.
Let's go to an email, Professor Smith, this one for you from Steve in Minnesota. Please speak to the idea that the sequester is an option that Congress could at any point decide not to enforce it and simply vote it out of existence.
Oh, well, sure. Yeah, they could, if they voted to change it, they could do that. So, yeah, but I think it's very difficult to come to agreement. And at the end of the day, it's kind of a tug of war of where we're going to end up, with a bigger or a smaller government. And so in a sense, there's not that much to compromise on because they just have different goals. And so they end up being forced to someplace in the middle, kind of at the last minute. I think one difference is that with Clinton and Bush, they were both kind of different from their party bases. You could call them centrist, but that's a matter of perspective. But, I mean, certainly Bush was a much bigger spender than most Republicans would want him to be, and Clinton was more willing to sort of economize. And they were both, in certain ways at least, they were closer to the center, where I think Obama's more kind of a standard-issue liberal, and so he has less to kind of offer to the other side. And as far as them going on vacation, I mean, if they think their sequester is a better option than any compromise deal they're going to come to, I wouldn't necessarily hold it against them to say, let's just let it go through.
Thanks, Jonathan. Chris in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I would like to make the case for raising taxes on the rich. When George W. Bush came into office and found the Clinton surplus, he said the money belonged to the rich, and he gave them tax breaks. Now we have a deficit. Why shouldn't the rich be the ones to close it? I don't understand why all the profits go to the rich and all the debts have to be paid by the rest of us.
Professor Isberg.
Well, you know, there's a lot of validity to the point that your caller is making here. If you take a look at, the fact that we've had one of the largest redistributions of income in the history of Western civilization, and it's taken place in a stable democracy. And, you know, a big part of that has to do with the interest rate environment and the mortgage market and the fact that, you know, consumers have used a lot of credit to fund their consumption. And what that has steadily done is it's reallocated a lot of the income from the consumers up to, a relatively smaller group of investors who are invested in financial institutions and corporate interests. So there has been a redistributed effect of what's happened over the last 40 years. You know, there's some mutual responsibility here, too, because, you know, the American public has been willing to use credit to purchase a lot of items that, in many cases you could argue they could have done without. And that did get a lot of people into trouble, and it got a lot of people into trouble, you know, prior to the collapse of the credit industry in 2008. So there is some mutual responsibility, but there's a lot of validity to the point your caller's making. You know, there's been a shift, and the shift has been enabled by the system, and there have been beneficiaries to that, and it's not necessarily out of line to ask them to pay a slightly higher share.
Go ahead, Professor Smith.
The rich do pay a lot of taxes already, so it's not as if, I mean, it's really not true to say that the benefits go to the rich and the rest of us pay the debts. Like, no, the rich pay a majority of the taxes already. And second, we've just raised taxes on them a couple months ago. And there are reasons to at least worry somewhat about redistribution through the tax code, because if you're going to be charging a 50%, 60% marginal tax rate on somebody who has a lot of money, first of all, they have incentives to find tax shelters, which might be economically inefficient. They have an incentive not to work as hard. And at the end of the day, it's through people coming up with sort of risky innovations, taking a lot of risk, working really hard, and sometimes that makes people really rich. That's what grows the economy. It leads to a lot of inequality, but that may be what you need to set up the right incentives to grow the economy. But it is disturbing that there's been so much of an increase in inequality. I think that's mainly due to just forces in how the economy works. I mean, just to give one example, think about how easy the Internet makes it to reproduce things. Well, suddenly, if you're the best singer, you can completely crowd out all the local street musicians because everybody can download your music onto an iPod. So it becomes this kind of winner-take-all model, and that's just due to the cost of reproduction. I mean, it's a way, it's great for us. We all get to listen to the best singers, but for people in the music industry, the consequence is that you get the winners taking all, and then you have a lot of starving artists. And I think more and more sectors of the economy tend to be becoming like that. So it's this kind of side effect of technological change, and it's hard to know exactly what to do about it.
Well, and when you get into that issue, you take a look at the fact that, you know, again, I'll point back to what low interest rates have enabled. You know, the $28 billion buyout of Heinz that was announced two weeks ago. You know, there is investment capital out there that a relatively small group of investors were able to borrow to fund a huge buyout of a company that will probably result in fewer jobs and lower compensation for the employees that remain after that company is restructured. And, you know, what we've seen over the years is an increasing consolidation of the control of corporate assets, and there's an interesting paper written by a physicist about this. And one of the things that he concludes is that, you know, the consolidation of that kind of control adds to the instability of the system, creates an instability. And, you know, we saw some of that back in 2008. So, you know, one of the things that we may want to consider here is, you know, how do we eliminate the opportunities to create these winner-take-all markets that we're seeing develop and emerge in the economy? So maybe instead of talking about the deficit, the federal government should be sitting down and talking about, you know, how do we go back and more rigorously enforce antitrust rules, and how do we create a set of rules that will encourage investment in growth industries as opposed to consolidation of existing industries. Mm.
I'm wondering if there have been, I want to get back to those companies that are sitting on trillions of dollars right now because of the uncertainty of the economy. And we were talking about risks. Professor Isberg, are there examples of companies that have taken risks, opened up areas, be it, I don't know, clean energy or transportation or whatever the field might be, created jobs, and have done just fine, thank you?
Well, I'm sure there are. I think they're going to be relatively small compared to the amount of money that's been put into the industries that are consolidating. I mean, one of the interesting things is if you take a look at, well, I'll give you two examples. Nordstrom, which is an upscale retailer, $8.5 billion in total assets, and they're sitting on about $2.5 billion in cash, and no one seems to care. Apple Computer, which is a company that you would consider to be more of a risk taker, more of an innovator, they're sitting on quite a huge pile of cash, and the investors are livid. So there's an interesting example of what you've just pointed to. You know, are the investors going to tolerate that risk-taking behavior in this environment, or are they more tolerant of the accumulation of cash and the use of leverage to repurchase stock, which is artificially inflating stock prices? You know, if you take a look at where a lot of the corporate cash flows have gone over the last 5 years, an awful lot has gone back into leveraged repurchase of shares, which is, you know, one reason why you saw the stock market top 14,000 in the same week that it was announced that the economy slowed down and unemployment rate went up.
Thanks, Chris, very much for the call. Marie is next in Bayview. Hi, Marie.
Hello. Hello. Now I have a frog in my throat. Okay, you'll have to live here past the frog. I think that Congress, the whole government, is nibbling around the edges. We need to solve more intrinsic basic problems, and those problems are our tax code and our health care system. And that's where the big money is. That's where the big money is. We need to do that, and also, I think, straightening out the tax code might give the little guy a chance. A large corporation hires lawyers, pays no money in taxes. a small company pays what it should.
Professor Smith.
Well, yeah, tax reform might be a good idea. As far as health care, of course, back in 2009, they tried to fix that. Now they're implementing that. We'll see how that works out. I think it's very hard to fix, partly because in some ways it might be good if market mechanisms could operate a little bit more, if people just had to pay for more of their treatment out of pocket, and then they might think about how to control the cost. But for some reason, there seems to be a strong preference for insulating people from the cost of health care, and if you do that, it's very hard to get the incentives right. Yeah, you can try to sort of control expenditures in a top-down fashion. Some other countries do that, but it tends to lead to long wait times and a lot of other problems that Americans might be reluctant to put up with. But fixing health care is very difficult, and we've just had one attempt, which is still underway, and we'll see how that pans out. And as far as the tax code, yeah, you probably would have tax reform. Tax reform would be a good thing. I think many economists would say that something like the corporate tax, for example, should actually be eliminated. So that's sort of the opposite of the popular instinct, because they'd say ultimately the corporate tax is paid by customers and by workers and by various stakeholders in the corporation. The corporation isn't a person. It's just sort of a temporary collective to try to organize work and organize financing. And ultimately, it's going to be paid by some individuals, but the corporate tax code just makes it a lot less transparent and a lot less efficient how that's being done. Many tax reform proposals will say that rates should be lowered, but there should be fewer deductions. So, for example, Bowles Simpson had a proposal a few years ago, Senator Bowles and Senator Simpson, which would eliminate the mortgage interest tax deduction. And it would raise a lot of money that way. In general, they went after tax spending a lot. But, of course, a lot of people feel like they deserve the mortgage interest tax deduction. We've enjoyed it for years and years. They're accustomed to that, and people would feel like that was a tax hike. And so I think there's a lot of resistance to tax reform. Politicians love to talk about closing loopholes, and then they'll pick loopholes that don't affect many voters, and they also don't affect very much money. Fundamentally, if you want to reform taxes, it's going to hurt somebody, and that person is going to resist a lot. And not just so-called the rich. It's going to hurt probably a lot of ordinary middle-class people, too, if it's done in a way that sort of has a good economic rationale. And that's difficult politically. So I don't necessarily think it's such a bad thing that if we put that off for a while, if we start to bring spending under control a bit, start to raise revenue a bit, and I guess to that extent, maybe just solving part of the problem today and leaving some of it for tomorrow could be a reasonable approach.
Let's go back to this issue of partisan politics and how we keep approaching and going over these fiscal cliffs, or we will tomorrow, because we have completely different philosophies. There is an email that has come in. Professor Isberg, let's start with you on this. At what point does partisan politics become unpatriotic? What about serving in the public interest?
Well, I think that's one of the inherent problems that has crept into our political system. I think that, you know, because access to financial resources to succeed in being reelected is so important, that people in Congress have lost sight of who they are representing. You know, when a paid lobbyist has more easy access to a congressman's office than a constituent. And, you know, the lobbyist may or may not have a direct interest in that congressman's state. You know, something is wrong. You know, when legislation is written by staffers, or actually in some cases written by the lobbyists in the staffer's office, you know, when you have lobbyists drafting legislation, you know, they're certainly in there drafting it with the view of creating a benefit for whoever they are representing. And, you know, there's a ton of money being poured into lobbying right now. And most of that money is well organized. Most of that money is coming from fairly small, centralized economic interests. And they have an interest in seeing regulatory policy structured in a certain way. They have an interest in seeing tax policy structured in certain ways. They'll drop little things into bills that are totally unrelated to, you know, the subject of that particular bill to create a benefit for a particular industry or a group. And you get to the point where you feel like the individual, which when you put the individual, the individuals together to form the nation, that we're underrepresented in Congress right now. You know, this is, and that's a significant issue that we need to deal with. You know, just coming back briefly to what the last caller was talking about, right now 10% of all of our revenue, tax revenue, comes from corporate tax, 42% comes from payroll taxes, and any small business owner is going to tell you that, you know, that their growth is inhibited by the amount of payroll taxes that they have to pay.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the sequester, which is likely to happen tomorrow, and asking the overall question is, should we be worried about this, and why are we continually at a point where we just can't seem to agree on what needs to be done? We have two guests with us, Professor Steven Isberg, associate professor of finance at the University of Baltimore, and Nathan Smith, assistant professor of business administration, finance, and economics at Fresno Pacific University. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hour two of the program, a wildly different topic. We'll talk with the biographer of Bruce Springsteen. The new book is Bruce, and the author, Peter Ames Carlin, will be joining us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Mike in Appleton. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. Well, listening to all of this, it's kind of scary. And so I have a comment and then a possible partial solution, if you could hear me out. So one of your guests said that for the last 5 years, the Fed has been pumping money into the economy to keep interest rates low. So, you know, the question is, well, how long can that go on? This is kind of like, I guess you would call it fake money that is being printed, keeping interest rates low. What happens when interest rates, you know, double or triple? I mean, that's inevitably going to happen. And then on the other hand, over the course of the next 15 years, there's going to be an awful lot of people who are going into retirement and who are going to be, you know, demanding Social Security, Medicare, and all of that. it seems like we're destined to come up against a brick wall pretty quickly.
Professor Isberg, if you'd like to start.
Well, again, one of the dangers of continuing to increase your money supply, and it's not necessarily that they're printing the money. What they're doing is they're creating the reserves. The reserves get into the banking system, and that allows for the creation of what we would call credit money. So they're not really printing much of anything. You know, the biggest danger that I think we face right now in this regard is what will happen to commodity prices. You know, commodities are real goods, you know, oil, copper, grain. And, you know, the prices of those goods have been creeping up. And any time you increase your money, your supply of money relative to those commodities, you know, the price of those commodities is going to creep up. And that can be very, very inflationary. If you take a look at the food industry right now, look at grocery stores, some of the healthiest grocery stores right now are struggling with low margins because they're trying to keep their prices to their customers low. And, you know, as a result, for example, Kroger Corporation, $90 billion in sales a year. They've added over $20 billion in sales in the last 3 years. But their margins have been tightening because they want to offer the lower prices to their customers, but their costs of goods have gone up because the commodity prices have gone up. And, you know, eventually what could happen is, you know, you could see an outburst of inflation. And in that particular case, the response on the part of the regulators is going to be to tighten the money supply. You know, last time they did this, it kind of led into the collapse of the credit industry about a year later. A lot of people don't realize that back in 2006, the Federal Reserve reduced the amount of federal debt that it held by about one half, and that started interest rates moving the wrong way and started the economy moving the wrong way, and a year and a half later we ended up with a credit market collapse. So there's that much potential instability in the system right now, and that's a danger that has to be addressed.
Thank you, Mike, very much for the call. Professor Smith, let's go to your response to Bernie from Elkhorn's comment on email. Social Security has not added a dime to the deficit. It can easily be tweaked to be solvent beyond the current 20 years. Why no talk about military spending? Per Joseph Stiglitz, $4 to $5 trillion on the Iraq war alone, over $1 trillion a year when all agencies are added up. Also, corporate welfare. Why no talk of reducing these dramatically? Why drain social programs?
Okay, so Social Security, say it hasn't had added a dime to a deficit, that's kind of meaningless. I mean, if you match payroll taxes with Social Security benefits, then yes, so far it's been sufficient to cover it, but of course you could have spent those payroll taxes on other things if we weren't spending so much on Social Security. And in the long run, Social Security is definitely a big problem for the deficit. That said, to some extent it's true. I mean, I wouldn't call it minor tweaks, but yes, if you raise taxes, you could finance Social Security benefits. If you reduce benefits, and there's a lot of different ways of doing that, you can raise the retirement age, you can change the formula by which benefits are indexed to inflation. So it can be fixed, and it's easier, I would say, to fix Social Security than it is to fix Medicare. But I think it's not really accurate to think that this isn't a part of the long-run deficit problem. Furthermore, it's a bigger problem than the Iraq War, because the Iraq War, it was a temporary spending. Now that's pretty much done. I mean, there's still some, I guess, more veteran benefits that you have to pay, but for the most part, that's over. Whereas Social Security, it always took up a much bigger share of GDP than the Iraq War. I mean, even at the height of the Iraq War, we were spending a lot more on Social Security than we were on the Iraq War, and that's going to continue into the indefinite future, whereas the Iraq War is pretty much done. And then as far as, I mean, again, I don't want to get into national security. It's not my field, but, you know, that was the judgment that the leaders had about how to, you know, how we needed to respond to 9/11. That may be right or wrong, but that's somewhat a separate issue from how you deal with the budget deficit. I would also like to respond just to the point about inflation. I mean, about the Fed printing so much money. We don't have much inflation right now. I think this is not the thing to be worrying about right now. Yes, in the medium run, there could be an increase in inflation, and the Fed will respond to that as they need to do. But I think that's not really the danger that we're facing right now. The Fed recently said that they would keep engaging in quantitative easing. It's expanding the money supply until unemployment fell below 6.5%. And I support that. I think that was a wise decision. In some ways, I'm being a real defender of the establishment this morning, both the Federal Reserve and Congress. But
that's okay. You can defend whatever you want to.
Well, again,
you're the guest.
The inflation rate may not be high, but the bigger problem with the inflation is, again, it's been continuous. We haven't had a deflation. We've had constant inflation since 1944, and it has eaten away at the recovery. If you adjust the GDP growth for the last 5 years and you take the inflationary effects out, the real GDP growth is almost zero, and real incomes are going down. And that's a big concern. And, you know, I understand where a lot of economists look at the inflation rate and say, well, it's not too high. But, you know, when you consider the inflation rate may be at 2 to 2.5%, and anybody who's got a bank deposit is earning about 0.02% on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the real value of your wealth is declining.
Real interest rates being low, that can be a problem for people who want to make returns. But, of course, there's two ways to fix that. One is you could lower the inflation rate a lot, but you could also, if interest rates were higher, if returns on investments were higher, then nominal returns were higher, then even with some inflation, you'd still be getting a decent return. I think commodity prices have risen, and that's not all the Federal Reserve's fault. Part of that is, in a way, as perverse as it may sound to say so, but the higher gas prices are good news about the world economy, because the reason gas prices are so high is because in the past decade or so, there's been a lot of growth in many places around the world, in places like Africa, certainly in China that's continued, and Latin America's had a fairly good past few years. Really, the entire world did relatively well in a few years before the financial crisis. There was a bit of a hiccup during the financial crisis. If you're looking at it from the perspective of developed countries, of the United States and Europe, we've never really recovered from the financial crisis. We only partially recovered from it. We've never really gotten back to the trend. But in developing countries, a lot of those have continued to grow at a fairly strong pace, and so they demand gasoline, and that raises prices. And so in a way, that's a way to be cheerful when you look at the high prices at the pump. Why are they so high? Because a lot more people worldwide are entering the middle class and being able to buy cars and use gasoline. So hopefully that makes people feel a little bit better.
Except they can't breathe. Right? I mean, there are a whole host of problems there. Let's go to Patricia in Madison. Hi.
Hi there. Good morning. First of all, I want to reiterate what your guest said at the beginning of the program, that sequestration was an idea agreed upon by Obama and both sides of the political aisle. I mean, this isn't something that the Republicans have dreamed up. Obama keeps asking for a compromise, but before the end of last year in averting the fiscal cliff, the Republicans acceded to raising taxes on the rich, but Obama and Democrats did not offer any tax cuts. So now he's still out there campaigning. Maybe he doesn't realize he's already won the election, and he's putting the onus on the Republicans.
Professor Isberg.
Well, there's an interesting book out. The author's name is escaping me right now, but he talked about the Obama administration's negotiations with the Republicans back prior to the election.
Bob Woodward?
Excuse me?
Bob Woodward.
No, it wasn't Woodward's book. It's a different author. You know, he claimed that the Obama administration was acting with a certain degree of naivete and probably could have gotten more concessions than they actually did. And he actually gives Obama a lot more credit than most people in the media do for being somewhat willing to compromise. I think, you know, if you take a look at the Republican side of the coin, you had the Tea Party revolt of 2010, and I think that influenced the Republicans in terms of, you know, creating some more obstinacy when it came to negotiating on tax cuts and tax increases and spending cuts. Right now, again, the Republicans just seem to me to be very obstinate, and I think President Obama might be taking the attitude that since he did win the election, that he's got more of a mandate, and he may not be as willing to negotiate as he did before, and I think there might have been a significant opportunity lost to do something serious before the election took place.
Has he done enough, though, in the last 4 years to address this problem? Has he paid attention to cutting superfluous programs?
Well, I would say this in his defense. You know, imagine being elected president, okay, and the day you walk into office, you're dealing with the most significant credit collapse in recent history.
Yes.
You're dealing with a two-front war. You're dealing with a divided Congress. So those are the problems. It's welcome to the White House, Mr. Obama. Here's what you have to do.
We didn't have a divided Congress when he came in. He had all Democrats, right?
Well, no, I think he still had a Republican House at the time. I think he had a Democratic Senate. I think you recall he had a Republican House. In
Republicans
any case,
took the House in 2010, but for a couple of years he had Democrats.
He had huge problems to deal with, and he wanted to tackle the health care issue as well. So, you know, I would give him a little bit of credit for, you know, he had to deal with the war issue, and I think he's dealt with that. You know, he's basically gotten us out of Iraq. He's tapering us down in Afghanistan. And, you know, we've yet to see what the long-term outcome in Afghanistan is going to be. The problem he's created with Iraq is that, you know, as bad as Saddam Hussein used to be, he was the buffer between Israel and Iran, and he's gone now, and we're going to have to fill that gap. So we're always going to have to be involved in that particular region one way or another. Historically speaking, many empires have ended in Afghanistan, the Dutch, the British, the Russians. And here we've been tied up in Afghanistan for 10 years.
Long time.
It's not a good thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a very difficult place to get out of. So.
And on that note, we'll have to go. Afghanistan, it's a difficult place to get out of. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us this hour. We'll see what happens the next few days.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Our thanks to Professor Steven Isberg, Associate Professor of Finance at the University of Baltimore. Professor Nathan Smith is Assistant Professor of Business Administration, Finance, and Economics at Fresno Pacific University. You can count on our talking about this issue on Monday, of course, on All Things Political, when we see what happens the next couple days, and the effects of this sequester are to be seen more significantly in the next couple months. So we're on the story. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for your calls and listening. News is coming up. We'll return.